From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2009 when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State. Clinton decided that she would do all of her government emailing on her private account. She never used a government account, and that allowed Clinton and her staff to control which emails would be released to the public. Recently, her team has said they've turned over 55,000 pages of emails from Clinton's term as Secretary of State. They have yet to say how many pages they have withheld and why. That same decision, if made today, would violate the law, which is designed to preserve such communications for the public record. Critics say Clinton is thwarting the public's right to access. Clinton's allies say she was more comfortable with a private account, but she technically didn't break the law. Meanwhile, Andrew Cuomo's administration has begun implementing a new policy, well, new as of 2013, to automatically delete emails of state workers once those emails are 3 months old. That's resulted in an effective purge of thousands of email messages related to New York State business, economic policy, health care, and more. New York State's got a contract with Microsoft, which allows for 50 gigabytes of email storage per employee. Watchdog groups have estimated that this would be enough to store 30 years' worth of email messages, but the Cuomo team claims automatic deletion after 3 months is the more efficient approach. This hour, we're looking at public access to information, and beyond the Clinton and Cuomo emails, we're looking at the state of freedom of information. Later this hour, we're going to hear from the executive director of the New York State Committee on Open Government, but first let me introduce my guests for the hour, a pair of reporters who file freedom of information requests on a regular basis. David Riley is a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle. Nice to see you back in studio, David.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also here is Rachel Barnhart, an anchor and reporter with WROC-TV and author of the blog called The Rochesterian. Rach, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel, your last freedom of information request was filed how long ago?
About 3 hours ago.
Yes. And you said in this case that you got a response how quickly?
I did. So with the Rochester City School District and everything going on with the superintendent, I filed several requests for his contract, for the list of people in his superintendent employee group and their salaries. And then I filed for one other thing. And two of the three I got within 10 minutes.
Okay, so
which is highly, highly unusual.
That is unusual.
But I don't think I'm the only person to ever requested that stuff, so they may have just had it on hand, but they were very quick about it.
They might just be so annoyed that it's you all the time that maybe they just respond more quickly?
No, because I have ones that are outstanding for months and months with the city school district, so that's not true.
David, your last request, do you know when it was?
I can more readily remember the last one that I received a response to, which was for documents related to the marina project up at the port and sort of what happened there with the contractor last year. The project sort of hit a snag, hit a delay. I finally got a response to that a couple weeks ago. We filed that back in November, so.
And that's an example of a great story that resulted from a FOIL request because we finally got an answer to why this company pulled out of the port.
You're going to hear some terms this hour, FOIL or FOIA. FOIL is the state law, Freedom of Information Law. FOIA is a term more related to a federal request. But the bottom line is we use it as a verb. We FOIL something. At least I do. Do you guys still use FOIL as a verb?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I try never to use it in print, though.
Yeah, right.
It means nothing to the
yes,
public.
It means nothing to the public. But if the public wants to weigh in, we do want to hear what you think about some of these developments and just some process questions, because we're going to try to peel back the onion this hour that I think is important. If it bores some people, it doesn't bore me. I'd like to know as much as we can. And Rachel and David have a lot of experience in this arena. We're going to talk about what they decide to FOIL, to ask for in terms of records and why. But let me also ask what they think about the recent information on the emails and whatnot, which don't even technically fall under FOIL. Bob Freeman, who's going to be on with us later this hour, has said Hillary Clinton's emails, Andrew Cuomo's emails are more with archivists and different records than the State Committee on Open Government. But I think that they are of a piece in that does the public have access and should they? So, Rachel, I'll start with you. Do you have any concerns about what you've read about Hillary Clinton, Andrew Cuomo, and their situation with emails?
Well, sure. Most of us communicate by email now, and that includes government. Cuomo's policy of automatically deleting emails after 90 days raises a lot of concerns, especially for journalists who need access to information. Now, Cuomo's administration says that they are going to be going through emails and ones that could be FOILable or related to policy, those ones they are going to keep. But that's extremely labor-intensive, and there are no guarantees. In fact, the Cuomo administration, even deleted emails relating to a lawsuit, and that had been foiled already. So there are already examples of where this policy could be very troubling. The other thing is, I mean, I have done stories based on emails that I have foiled. One in particular had to do with Mayor Lovely Warren's uncle, who, you know, remember the security guard controversy. As a result of foils for documents related to that, we found out that the police chief, the interim police chief at the time, recommended against doing something like this and pointed out all of these problems with creating this position. If the mayor had used her personal account or her staff had used their personal accounts to have these discussions, the public never would have found that information out. So emails are really important, and access to those kinds of emails are really important.
David, any concerns?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are two different cases, one at the federal level, one at the state level, but I think what they have in common is they seem like they're, to me, sort of a part of a pattern of public officials trying to control what ends up in the record, trying to dictate what's available to the public. And that's gone on since the beginning of time, but you would think that would be maybe a little bit less of a concern in the digital age. You would think emails are easier to store, easier to sort, easier to track than paper documents. But I think this is sort of part of a pattern that we've seen across parties, across levels of government, to try to sort of control the narrative.
Yeah, you know, on the Clinton side, in terms of what people are saying, her staff have defended it in several ways. And I thought Josh Voorhees wrote a very good analysis for Slate, in which Josh took on some of the defenses. One of the primary defenses is that Hillary Clinton is not the only one who has done this, that Jeb Bush has done this when he was governor of Florida, likely for the same reasons, that Colin Powell and others. And Josh Voorhees writes in Slate, that doesn't make it right. If other public leaders, of no matter their party designation, are using personal or private email accounts, and then they are dictating what the public ought to see, that's not a good reason for Hillary Clinton to do it, is it?
Well, one can look at Governor Cuomo, who would use the BlackBerry instant messaging, and their staff would use the BlackBerry instant messaging because that was a way they'd disappear. There's no record of instant messages. And so I'm not sure if it's a good defense, but I think it's probably very, very common, because if you think about the way we communicate, we use text messages, we use instant messages, we use Facebook, you know, there are so many different ways we communicate that using personal devices to communicate, or even personal accounts, I suspect it's incredibly common. Now, to do it for an entire term as Secretary of State, that seems highly unusual, but I think that they're probably all elected officials use personal accounts for business.
Didn't somebody get an email from her and see the handle and wonder, you know, aren't you supposed to be on an official government email? I don't know. I mean, I think I can't be the first who've asked that question. But here's what Josh Voorhees writes in Slate as to that point regarding how we got to this point. Hillary Clinton has said only this. She's offered one tweet since this all came out about a week ago. She tweeted that she wanted the public to see the emails, that there were 55,000 emails, and that she wanted the public to have access to them. But Josh Voorhees writes this, quote, when she tweets that she wants the public to see all 55,000 emails, she is willfully misreading the question. The emails to which she was referring are not the issue. Those were the messages that her own team, the only people with access to her private account, had already decided were safe to be archived by the government and eventually made public. Releasing those emails ahead of schedule would do nothing to refute the idea that Hillary Clinton intentionally sought out a legal gray area from which to do her business, an act that privileged her own privacy and likely political aspirations above the public record and potentially above the nation's security. So when you see the number of 55,000 emails, that's right. It's kind of a meaningless number that seems to be meant to be made this whole thing big. But when it comes to the Cuomo administration's habit of now deleting after 90 days, I don't see anything illegal about that. I don't see that is technically against the law. It just might make it more difficult for journalists. So David, for example, if that's not illegal, there's not a whole lot we can say about it, you know, to change it. Is that right?
No, I don't think it is illegal on my reading of the law, typically, governments are required to keep schedules of how long they have to retain records for, and not many things are retained permanently, but they're often retained for years, not weeks or months in this case. So a 90-day limit seems really tight to me, and I can tell you how many times we've found out about something weeks, months after it's happened, or don't get a sense of what we should be asking for until months later, and it could well be gone by then. Part of the difficulty, I think, is that the law doesn't really talk specifically about email. We're talking about a pretty antiquated law. It talks about computer tapes and microfilm. Maybe it would be helpful if the law actually spelled out some particulars.
Well, speaking of, you know, either antiquated or at least strange, what's the response of the Cuomo administration to this? I want to read the defense of this from Maggie Miller, who used to be the Girl Scouts of America executive. She's now the state's chief information officer as of December. And here's how she spins the idea that the Cuomo administration wants state emails deleted after 90 days. Quote, "The consolidation of our email systems is revolutionizing how we as a state communicate and collaborate with each other. Before this email system consolidation, we as partner agencies could not readily find each other's contact information. Now we can easily communicate, collaborate, plan, schedule conference calls and meetings, and manage our online correspondence consistently and effectively. This is a significant accomplishment, and I want to thank everyone for their hard work in making government work better." End quote. Maggie Miller responding to a question about deleting emails in the most bizarre way I think you could. I did not know that they could not find each other's email address before they started deleting
now
emails.
Now there's a state senator, I think it's Liz Krueger, who's introduced a bill to stop this from happening, stop this 90-day policy from going into effect. So we'll have to watch the fate of that.
It's a certain amount of hypocrisy in the legislature criticizing this, though, because they're not subject to FOIL either, which is a nice little loophole they've carved out for themselves. So it's a little hard for me to
So state lawmakers, David and I were talking before the show, we both have gotten tips, you know, you need to look into your local state representatives because they are using personal email accounts. There's a Morelli.com account. I noticed Harry Bronson's staff uses a Gmail. And as David just said, their emails aren't subject to FOIL. So for our purposes, you know, asking about this is kind of a moot point because it's something they're allowed to do. And I've since asked several people that I know who work in other offices with state lawmakers, and they say they do a mix between the state email and the personal email system. Some of it does have to do with technology and not being able to access the state system at certain locations, but it's an extremely common practice.
Well, Jake writes to us, "What is the scope and cost of a Freedom of Information request? The simple solution here is to request the last 3 months of emails every 2 months."
Oh, that would be astronomically expensive.
Get a rather large bill, I suspect.
Well, let's talk about the cost then. I think it's a good question from Jake because, again, the public is not always aware of what journalists have to do behind the scenes to try to get information, even if you're not going to use all of it. Sometimes you want a broader look at before you're... David Riley is not including everything in a story he writes for the Democrat and Chronicle. You're not going to include everything that you discover in foiling.
Lord, no.
Goodness, and thank you for not... but let's talk about the cost. And David, you want to walk us through what a scenario is like for the process and the cost?
Sure. It varies widely depending on the agency you're dealing with. If you're requesting something that's kept in a digital format and doesn't really have to be gone over by an attorney or redacted or something like that because there's potentially sensitive information in it, you may get something that you want for free. You know, I've gotten databases from the state for free. Recently, I had to FOIL the State Commission of Correction for some information on deaths of local inmates at the county jail, and they provided that all to me at no cost. That said, you can be charged if there's if an employee has to spend time sort of going through and compiling the information for you. You can be charged sort of an hourly rate for what it takes that employee to pull it all together. If somebody has to go through and redact things, you can end up facing charges for that. You can even be charged by the page, up to a quarter a page, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it certainly adds up if you're getting 800 pages. So it really depends on who you're dealing with and what the format is.
If you're talking about by the page, being charged by the page, imagine hundreds or thousands of emails. And all of a sudden, Jake's idea, while I think is a nice one, not feasible at all. Rachel, it doesn't sound feasible.
No, it's not feasible. And it's an interesting point, though, about the 25 cents a page. I think that 25 cents has morphed into more of a labor charge than the cost of copying, a paper, because we get many of our FOIL documents via PDF on email. So there really is no physical cost to to giving us these records. And again, some places don't charge, and sometimes the same agency, you know, the city of Rochester will give me some things for free. Other things are going to charge me.
Let me grab a phone call. This is Mike in Rochester, and it's 844-295-TALK, by the way, 844-295-8255 if you want to join the conversation. Mike, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I just wondered what your people thought of that. I believe that state legislators and many elected officials within the state are supposed to be part-time in what we elect them to. They're supposed to carry on their lives, even their work lives, outside of their responsibility to us as taxpayers. But what's wrong with them having private accounts? They have private lives.
Mike, thanks for the call. I don't think there's anything wrong with having private accounts.
The question we're talking about is using their private accounts for official business and business related to their jobs as lawmakers. But it is our understanding that those communications we wouldn't be able to access anyway. And let's just say there's a lawmaker who's under investigation by the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney would be able to subpoena those records, those private records anyway. So from a journalist's perspective, delving into the issue of state lawmakers using personal accounts, it doesn't really solve any problem for us. It doesn't solve the problem for us. By law, we don't have access to that information anyway.
Go ahead, David.
I just want to say we should be clear. There's nothing in the law that says that a public official has to use a public account. It's that it becomes murky when they're dealing with public business that should be subject to public record that we should be able to foil if they're using their own Gmail or Hotmail account. It's sort of on them to decide what to release and decide gets into the public record in a way that if it's going through some sort of public account, you hope that it's not necessarily them deciding directly what gets to the public.
David Riley is a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle. Rachel Barnhart, an anchor and reporter with WROC-TV. And coming up later this hour, we're going to hear from Bob Freeman, the executive director of the New York State Committee on Open Government, as we talk about, in the wake of the Hillary Clinton email situation, Andrew Cuomo's state policy regarding the deletion of state emails. We're talking about freedom of information, the process, and generally whether it's working. And it sounds like, you know, Rachel's experience this morning, she got a quick response, but David, you said the last one you received information on, that was filed back in November?
Yeah. Actually wasn't even filed by me. It was filed by Brian Sharp, one of my colleagues at the DNC, when he was covering City Hall. And in the city's defense, they were between communications directors and the person who's in charge of overseeing that stuff. So I think that might have contributed to the delay.
Well, Mara wants to know, how long does a government agency have to respond?
Yeah, I was going to say, you were saying it seems like the system's working. I don't think the system works at all on two fronts. They have to respond to us within 5 days to acknowledge receipt of our request and give us kind of a general time frame. But they're under no obligation to abide by that time frame, and they frequently will send us things, you know, extending them out. Also, you know, they don't have to. They can drag their feet for as long as they want to. They don't have to give us what we're asking for, or they could just flat out deny it. And it's incumbent upon the person making the request to jump through all the hoops, then to appeal. And the same people deciding your appeal are the people granting the requests. If the city of Rochester denies my FOIL request, guess who I have to appeal to? The city of Rochester. So they get to review their own decision. And ultimately, you could end up having to go to court. Now,
And they often count on you not either wanting to deal with it or having the financial
having the resources. Yes. Many newsrooms do not have the resources to go to court all the time. And remember, too, sometimes we're asking for things that we don't even know if they exist or not. So if you know something exists, it's a lot easier to fight for it than if you're going on, say, a fishing expedition. Then it's a lot easier for them to just say no or say something doesn't exist. But I have a spreadsheet that I use to track all my FOIL requests, and I would say, and it goes back a year, and I would say half of them haven't been filled, and we're talking about the city, the county, and the city school district.
David, what do you make of that? She's saying in many ways then that system is not working.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's been my experience too. I've made requests that have dragged out for months, 6 months, longer sometimes. And the frustrating thing is sometimes when you're denied with very little explanation. The agency might cite one of the exceptions that's allowed under the law, that maybe it's there would be an unwarranted violation of privacy of somebody who's named in the documents, that it would somehow compromise a law enforcement investigation. But rarely do you get any clear explanation of how those documents actually fall under the exemption. So you're sort of left scratching your head saying, how do I challenge this? Because they've given me very scant explanation.
Yeah, I mean, one effective tool is just call people out publicly and say, look what I asked for from the city, and look at their response and kind of put public pressure on them. But there's another problem with FOIL too, and Bob Freeman has been a great resource, who you're going to have on at 1:30. He's been a great resource for me over the last 10 years. I'll call him, and we talk a lot about the intent of a request. You know, a lot of times, you know, you try to word your Freedom of Information request in such a way that it covers what you want. But a lot of agencies get really cute. If you get one word, they'll figure out a way to not fill your request. For example, I wanted to know why a Fairport principal resigned, so I asked for resignation letters, termination letters, severance agreements, and all I got was his resignation letter in return. But the resignation letter referred to a separation agreement. And so then I had to file another FOIL for the separation agreement. My original request didn't say separation agreement, it said severance agreement. And so, you know, that's a great example of you know, really parsing the language to shield the public and to shield the public from information.
Are newsrooms training reporters, and are young reporters especially coming into the field, trained well enough to handle this? Because I think this is such an important area of being able to navigate FOIA and FOIL. And if they are not adept at it, it's easy, like you said, to get a no or to not understand why you didn't get the information you're looking for. And all of a sudden, you know, your story is lacking. The public doesn't know. Are journalists well-trained enough on this, David?
I don't know. I can think of people who I know who have come into the field who don't necessarily know the ins and outs or sort of the art or science of how to craft a request that will get you what you want, or how to deal with pushback. The Democrat and Chronicle certainly tries to train people on how to deal with those things, and has incredibly knowledgeable people around the room who can
sometimes
help you with
it's
those
just
things.
A matter of having done it and doing it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to kind of stumble through it a few times. It's sort of a trial and error kind of thing.
Yeah, I learned on the job. I had mentors who taught me, now I teach others, and I can't emphasize enough how much Bob Freeman has helped me over the years. That's what he is there for, you know, in Albany. You can give him a call. He'll answer your questions. He'll tell you if a denial was proper. He'll tell you maybe how to word something. He cites case law. He's been a resource for me, and I think almost everything I know I learned from him.
I go back to Rachel's point on sometimes you have to tell the public when someone is simply not giving you information. And that is often the recourse when you feel like you're being denied something that you ought not be denied. I remember in 2006, the congressman from, I think it was the 29th district at the time, now the 20, Tom Reed's in the 25th? Is that Lou Slaughter? Boy, I lose the district numbers.
Well, Slaughter's the 25th.
Okay, yeah, so 26 maybe. But anyway, it was the 29th, and it was Randy Cool. He preceded Eric Massa, who preceded Tom Reed. And Randy Cool went to Brazil on a CODEL. That's a congressional delegation, a dozen members. It has to be bipartisan to do it. So Elliot Engel was a Democrat from New York City who organized it. And why were they going to Brazil on the taxpayer's dime? Well, they went to learn about how the Brazilians are using energy, and particularly sugar, in terms of sugar ethanol and new forms of energy. And I wanted to know, well, what did that cost? How many politicians, what was the airfare? What did they do when they were there? And I remember calling Randy Cool's office, and they said, well, we didn't organize the trip, so don't ask us. So I said, okay, well, we'll talk to Elliot Engel's office. And the initial response was essentially, why do you want to know? And then it was, well, what do you want to know? And you have to be very, very specific. And then they said, well, we can't say what Randy Cool did. He has to give you the itinerary. And they said, no, Elliot Engel has to give you the itinerary. The story ended up being about the process. And here's where it ended up. They would give me the itinerary if I would go down to Washington, D.C. in person and make a photocopy. And I said, I'm in Rochester, New York. And they said, we've got the CODEL itinerary and information. You got to be here. I had to call a friend in D.C., have her come in the middle of her workday and make a copy. And we did. And we did an entire story on the ridiculous nature of the process. I think it got a lot of traction. And Randy Cool attacked us in a press release after that, saying, well, I'm happy to tell you how much this cost. And I said, well, if you're happy to tell us,
why did you
make us go back and forth so many times? And that's an example of what happened. So I think It can be very, very frustrating. Let me grab one more quick phone call before the break, and then we're going to bring in Bob Freeman. But this is Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Hi, interesting show. How do you validate this information? I mean, there, if I were, and I have 30-year information background, but, you know, you get emails and so forth from people, but how do you know they're the correct emails or they're from that person? So, for example, if I kept all the emails for a representative for a year and they deleted every 3 months, how could they, you know, disclaim that I hadn't fabricated an email? So it seems to me that passing around information, an essential part of it, is making sure that it's accurate. And how do you do that? Thanks very much for the show.
Good question, Bernard. Rachel, I'll start with you. How would you answer that?
I guess I haven't really had an experience where I felt something was fraudulent and needed to question it. I would hope that there have been times where you might see a press release that seems a little strange or seems odd, and I would hope that journalists, including myself, would do due diligence and not just put it out there and maybe make a phone call to make sure it's correct. But I can't say I've had an experience where a number of red flags have gone up.
Sure, and Bernard may be saying it's good that you feel that way, but you don't know.
Right.
For sure. Right.
Right. Well, we live in an age now where, you know, newsrooms get press releases all the time, and we typically just put them out without even making a phone call, to be honest with you.
No, you're not saying we. You're saying the general we. You're not talking about yourself.
No, I am. I am. I absolutely do that. I'll tweet something out immediately.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're not saying that you publish the press release as if it's a story
no.
you wrote. You're saying you'll take information directly
yes,
from a release.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And I've never had an experience where I felt something was a scam, but I would hope that you know, there would be a red flag if something was you know, just seemed ridiculous.
David Riley, how would you answer Bernard's question?
It's a great question, and I guess it kind of points to the flaw of the law, and that you sort of have to trust that what you're getting is what you're supposed to get is the information that's available and that it's reliable. I mean, certainly. You always go to the person you're writing about before you write about them and tell them, look, this is what we got in response to a FOIL request. And even if they don't want to talk to you, I'll often say, look, will you at least tell me you wrote this?
Sure. Have you ever suspected that you were lied to or not given the information that you sought?
No, not that I can think of. I mean, certainly a case where I think we had to be careful, and it's not really a FOIL case, but where we had to be careful about whether someone appeared to be someone online or it was someone else was the case with the mayor's social media accounts recently, where City Hall ultimately said that someone was posting from her accounts, but it wasn't her. And I remember in the initial story trying to be careful to say someone posting from the mayor's account, because we couldn't be sure that it was her. But no, I can't think of a FOIL case where that's come up.
Rachel?
You know, I can't think of a specific case. I'm racking my brain right now, but I absolutely know that I have done stories where FOIL has exposed previous lies, you know, or I will later say, oh my goodness, I FOIL'd that, and it turns out I wasn't given this. You know, later on something will come up. That's absolutely happened to me in my career, but I can't off the top of my head think of specific cases,
sure.
But it's happened.
And Richard wants to know, don't hold us in suspense, Evan, what happened in Brazil with the congressman? You're stretching my memory. It's 9 years. But what I can tell you is he did attend some sort of meetings about energy policy. He also spent some time on, if I recall correctly, and if the the former congressman's listening, I'm trying to do my best to be accurate and fair. There was staying in accommodations that were quite lavish, that most people would describe. Not the cheapest option, to be sure. There was an event down the Amazon River. It looked like a cruise. And military air was used to travel, which is quite expensive. But his office eventually said, we think it was worth the cost to gain what we learned about Brazilian energy policy. If Randy Kuhl ever used it before he was out of Congress, I don't know. But there you go. Let's take a 60-second break, and we're going to come back and talk to Bob Freeman, who is the executive director of the New York State Committee on Open Government, as we talk about your access on Connections. Stay with us. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, neurosurgeon and potential Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson recently said that prison proves being gay is a choice because people go to prison straight and come out gay. He's had to walk back those remarks, but we're going to have a conversation on the science of homosexuality. Then, we're going to talk to the author of Reconstructing Democracy, Grassroots Black Politics After the Civil War.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Veteran reporters David Riley and Rachel Barnhart are in studio with us. We'll get to your phone calls, more of your comments coming up, but let me bring in Bob Freeman, who is the executive director of the New York State Committee on Open Government. I know you've been hearing some of the conversation, Bob. This probably sounds quite familiar to you.
I've heard most of it before, yes, having been around for a while.
Bob, you just heard Rachel and David describe And to Bernard's very good question, describe the process that, to some degree, we have to trust government agencies that when we request information, they will deliver that. Is the system flawed inherently? Should it change in any way?
You know, it's a great question, and my belief is, and this is especially so probably for your colleagues there in the newsroom, local government, I think, does a terrific job in most instances in complying with FOIL. And there are reasons for that. Generally speaking, my belief is that as the size of the unit of government gets smaller, there is much more direct accountability. People know each other. If you walk into the town clerk's office in wherever it might be, in Fairport or Webster, chances are pretty good that if it's a routine request, the clerk is going to say, sure, it's over there. You dispense with the formality that is associated with FOIL in too many instances when the agency is larger. And I think, too, that most people in government try to do the right thing. They try to do a good job. But there's no question, but in some instances, there have been efforts, let's say, to thwart disclosure.
Before I get back to your phone calls, John and Geneva will come to you and some of your comments online. Bob, when you say that they try to thwart disclosure, the ways they do that, Rachel described, you have to have sometimes pinpoint wording, or they will claim that they gave you what you asked for and you didn't ask specifically enough. Is that the most common way, or are there other ways?
No, that's not the most common way, and in fact, it's the wrong answer under the law. You know, going back to the original version of FOIL, Freedom of Information Law, in 1974, it said that an applicant was required to seek identifiable records. So it was true. If you couldn't name the record, you were out of luck. But in 78, when FOIL was completely revised, the standard for making a request was changed also. It simply says now that an applicant must reasonably describe the record requested. So if the agency can figure out what you want, you have met your responsibility under FOIL. You don't have to pinpoint exactly what you want to make a valid request.
But that is a subjective arena, isn't it? And they will claim, well, what's a reasonable request in your world? I might not have understood it.
That's not the issue. The issue is whether you can find what so-and-so wants with reasonable effort. Mm-hmm. And the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, has told us that often significant is the nature of an agency's filing or record-keeping system. If we keep records in chronological order, gee, it's easy to find whatever it may be by date. Sometimes we keep records in alphabetical order, sometimes by location. And I've suggested to members of the public and reporters 1,000 times, find out how the agency keeps its records so that you can make a request that is consistent with the agency's filing or record-keeping or retrieval system.
So, for example, Bob, Rachel's example, that when she was kind of stonewalled, she wanted to know a principal's separation agreement, but the term, Rachel, you used
was severance.
Severance agreement, and they claimed, or their omission was essentially saying she did not ask for the right thing. Does that fly with you?
In a situation like that, what I would do if I were Rachel, and Rachel, you're very nice, and I'm a mean and nasty guy. I would tell the world, and I would say, gee, I don't think I really know the difference between a separation agreement and a settlement agreement, or whatever the words might have been. And yet, here's a school district that stonewalled regarding how public money was being expended. Huh, what do you think about that? And I, my guess is that embarrassment in so many instances will result in a disclosure. And I've suggested, these are not my words, but I've hearkened back to words offered by Judge Louis Brandeis. Now it's 102 years ago. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, and I really believe that to be so. But in the situation that you just described, there's no doubt that the request would have reasonably described the record. They would know what you're talking about.
I actually must not be that nice, Bob, because I did exactly what you said, and I put it all out there.
We spoke about it, didn't we?
Yeah, I put it all out there. Once I did get the records, I kind of told the story of here's what happened, so the public would know that they got really cute with my request.
So let me ask you, do they still fool around that way, or has a lesson been learned?
Well, I haven't made another request to the school district, so we'll have to see.
Maybe it's time.
Yeah.
Let me get back to the phones. Bob Freeman's on the line with us on Open Government. John in Geneva wants to weigh in. Go ahead, John.
Hi. I had a question regarding the costs associated with the FOIL and FOIA the request. I study in political science here at Homer and Wilson College, and unfortunately I don't have a background in this type of legislation, but how does the government justify the cost of these requests, given that you'd think that the information would be for anyone that wants it instead of people that might be able to afford it?
Well, first of all, you said FOIL and FOIA. FOIL is the abbreviation for the New York Freedom of Information Law. FOIA is the abbreviation for the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And the standards under those two provisions are completely different. In Washington, if you make a request, and it's pretty sophisticated and it deals with technical information, a federal agency can say, well, you know, we need to pay people with doctorates to review the materials to figure out what's public and what's not, and this is what we pay them on an hourly basis. This is what we're going to charge you. Now, in New York, it's a little bit different. Number one, and you're in Geneva, it's a relatively small community, if a record is accessible in its entirety, inspection is free. Inspection is free. If you want a photocopy up to 9 by 14 inches, the maximum that can be charged is 25 cents per photocopy. If you're requesting something else, something that is either larger than 9 by 14 or today, more typically, maintained electronically, if it takes 2 hours or less to honor the request, the fee is based upon the actual cost, which would be the cost of the tape or the disc or whatever it might be. If it takes 2 hours or more, the agency has the ability to establish a fee of based upon the hourly salary of the lowest paid employee able to do the job, which would involve the preparation of a record, such as entering queries, doing something to enable the agency to extract the data. So the fees in New York usually are not terribly significant. They're very different from the fees that can be assessed by federal agencies under the Federal Act.
Does that answer your question, John?
Yeah, that's my question. Thanks for the clarification.
Yeah, thank you, John, and thanks for the call. Bob, when I talked to you in preparation for this program, and again, kind of the hook for me, the hour, is that a lot of people are talking about access because of Hillary Clinton's emails and Andrew Cuomo's policy, his administration's policy of essentially auto-deleting after 90 days now, when watchdog groups are saying they've got the capacity to hold emails for 30 years. But you cautioned that your arena is outside of those. What do you make of that? Who's kind of taking a look at those particular angles with the emails?
Well, just to be clear about this, the Freedom of Information Law deals with what's public and what's not. It has nothing to do with the retention or disposal of records. That function historically has been carried out by the Commissioner of Education through the State Archives. The State Archives develops records retention schedules which indicate minimum retention periods for various kinds of records. And what I have suggested, to put this in perspective, FOIL deals with all government agency records, and we've been lucky. Since 1978, it has defined the term record to mean any information in any physical form whatsoever, kept, held, filed, produced, or reproduced by, with, or for a government agency. So whether it's the old-fashioned piece of paper or the videotape or email, it is a record that falls within the framework of FOIL. Now, to my mind, email is simply a means of communicating a record. What really counts in terms of disclosure, what really, in my opinion, should count in terms of a retention issue, is the content. Is the content important? Is it potentially important, or is it clearly insignificant? That's how I think a retention schedule should be developed, based upon the nature of the record, its content, and its significance.
Chad and Henrietta wants to weigh in as well. Go ahead, Chad.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I've been told, and that's what I've told my clients, that if the municipality keeps a record, let's say alphabetical, but the request is one in which it's date specific, that the municipality can have the requester come in and look through the records, but that the municipality doesn't have an obligation to do this page-by-page search through 70 or 80 years of records. Am I right on that, Bob?
Well, assuming that the 70 or 80 years of records are all public in their entirety, yes, yes. But let me give my silly, stupid phone book example. You live in Monroe County. I walk into Town Hall and I see the Monroe County phone book there, and I say, aha, a government agency record. I hereby request all the listings pertaining to those people whose last name is Smith. Piece of cake, because that's how the phone book is written. Smiths are easy to find. Even if there are 10,000 people with the same last name, the request would, in the words that I used before, the request would reasonably describe the record. Now, if I come back the next day and I say, you know, I like the Smith part. Now I want all the listings concerning those people whose first name is John. Well, that's when the agency can say, sorry, we maintain this grouping of records by last name in alphabetical order, not by first name. We're not required to go through this haystack in order to find the needles. Now, the agency could say in that situation, you can have the haystack and you can find the needles if you want. That's up to you. But I can't tell you that an agency would necessarily be obliged to do so. In so many instances, you know, if there is a tremendous amount of material, there is likely to be something in it that can be withheld. It might involve Social Security numbers. It might involve personal privacy. There are any number of possibilities.
Chad, does that answer your question?
I think it does. But once again, Bob is the reigning expert in the field, and I admire his patience and longevity.
I don't know who you are, but thanks anyway.
Thank you, Chad.
Although I think I've spoken to half the people in this state at least once.
Well, Bob, before I let you go, let me just ask you a couple other brief points here. I asked David and Rachel the question on how well reporters are being trained for this now. And so often they call you when they have these questions. I have been very defensive of our profession lately. We've had discussions on the future of journalism. Sometimes people get cynical about reporting. Actual journalism, I think, is still not only happening, but happening at a very high level. And that's partially why I've got people like the people I have in this room, for example. But at the same time, it's also fair to ask, as some journalism outlets get younger, are we seeing young and new journalists trained well enough in this? What do you think?
I think that many, many young journalists are absolutely green. And let's face it, you know, our society is quite mobile. If somebody moves to Rochester and works for a news media organization but is from Iowa, what kind of background does that person have regarding the law of New York? And, you know, the law in every jurisdiction is different. I do a lot of training for journalism students. I go to Newhouse, to NYU, to Columbia, to any number of journalism programs. And the kids are from all over the place, and it's difficult. I think it's difficult. My personal belief is that young journalists are not trained to the extent that they should. I don't know that they get the kind of editorial guidance that used to exist in a newsroom 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And I've suggested, as you sort of said, that in my opinion, it's more important than ever to have good, young, smart, professional journalists, because after all, anybody can establish a blog. And this goes to the question that came up earlier. What can we believe? It seems to me that we should have the confidence in professional journalists to believe that what they have told us is presented in an objective and a factual way. We can't necessarily rely upon that when we see the information that's posted on a blog.
I think that's well said. I can't agree more, and I think that often government agencies, not to say that every government agency or every person who works for the government is nefarious or hiding something. I don't feel that way. But they also know that a lot of reporters are green, and I think that's where Bob's work is so important. So let me wrap with this with you, Bob. What ought to change? If you had your way, what walls would come down that would make everything a little easier or a little more efficient or a little more sunlight into the process?
Interesting question. In terms of journalists, you know, I certainly love to offer training and education. I think that there used to be active professional journalism associations. They're not quite as active as they used to be. But, you know, once upon a time, I would speak before the Syracuse Press Club or the Society of Professional Journalists in Rochester or Buffalo or something like that. I think that those organizations should come back to life and should provide the kind of opportunities that used to be provided not so long ago. The other element which I would like to see, which we do see to some extent, if information is clearly public and it's relatively easy to find, it should be posted online, because that is the way that so many people acquire their information these days. They go online. And if we can make life easier rather than difficult, it seems to me that it's our responsibility to do that.
Robert Freeman is the executive director of the New York State Committee on Open Government. Thanks for sharing some time with us this afternoon and your expertise, as always, Bob.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is always mine.
He's always available. Rachel, how many times have you called him over the years?
Many, many, many times. In fact, you know, he knows me at this point. And again, he's a pretty great resource. And speaking of professional organizations, we did restart one here in Rochester a few years ago. And we've now have bylaws. We're putting together officer slate. The Rochester Media Association is still in its infancy, but we certainly want to do the things that Bob Freeman is suggesting.
David,
I'm a member. Have you had to call him?
I spent much of my career in the suburbs of Boston, so I was much more familiar with the open records law there. I think there are some details that are different in New York. So certainly from my early days here, I have called Bob and owe him many thanks.
Yeah.
But there's another reason to call Bob, aside from just, you know, getting professional advice. We quote him in stories, because he is an expert. So if you feel a government is not giving you information that they should be giving you, then you put a quote from Bob in the story saying, that's ridiculous, they should be doing this, the law says this. And it really lends some credibility to our story about the government withholding information.
Mm-hmm. Hannah says, just another media panel attacking Hillary Clinton. No, it's not. We are not attacking Hillary Clinton in any way, shape, or form. We're simply talking about access to what the public ought to have access for. And I think Bob's point is a good one. When the public can't get access, I think reporters ought to let the public know and then let the public decide how they want to respond to that. Maybe you care and maybe you don't. And then we'll see kind of going forward what changes. But let me start to wrap the conversation with David and Rachel with this. I want to know how you determine, David Riley, how do you determine what you want to FOIL? How many outstanding FOIL requests do you have?
I'd have to go back to the office and look at
my
folder. Yeah, I probably have 10, 12
at any
going
time,
on right
yeah.
now. Yeah, yeah, it sort of ebbs and flows. As much as anything, I like to use FOIL to try to double check what people tell us instead of relying on individual statements or sort of anecdotes. FOIL can help us find documents that back up what people tell us, may disprove what people tell us. FOIL can get you access to data that can help you evaluate the effectiveness of a government program or get a sense of its reach. It really is, I can't emphasize enough what a critical tool it is for reporters. And I think there's a danger in it sort of sounding like it's just a tool for the press. I can't think of how many important stories, how much important information has gotten out to the public because of this law. Stories that just never could have been done without getting access to documents that help us find things that no one would tell us on the record.
Can you think of a story that you've done even recently where a Freedom of Information request produced a story that you would not have been able to write without it?
The story I mentioned at the beginning of the show about the marina project at the port, certainly the city and Pike Company, the original contractor, did talk a little bit at the time about what had happened, but the letters that were released to us because of a Freedom of Information law request really gave a great more bit of detail about what happened there, what the concerns were with the project, mm-hmm. why the contractor ultimately felt it couldn't be done. We couldn't have done that story without FOIL.
And Rachel, you, as you mentioned, 5 days they have just to acknowledge receipt of a FOIL request. So you almost have to be thinking ahead as a journalist. What am I going to need if I ever am going to... Sometimes you can't possibly get a FOIL request meted out by a deadline.
I always say it's like Christmas when a FOIL request comes in the yeah, mail. I get so excited.
How many outstanding requests? Any idea?
I probably have about a dozen and going back quite some time. And also, if a government agency doesn't respond, you can consider that a denial. If it drags on forever, you can assume that that's a denial and that they just didn't give you the information. It's a de facto denial. But I like FOIL. I mean, FOIL is a great government accountability tool. I tend to really like financial stuff and data. And I've done some FOILs that I would say weren't necessarily for, didn't necessarily turn up huge serious issue stories, but were interesting. For example, I wanted to know how many cars were plugging into the electric vehicle charging stations that are all around the city now. Mm-hmm. Not many. But it ended up being a pretty interesting story about, you know, this technology and why the city did this. And it turns out the numbers are going up, even though it's still pretty small. I also did a story about how many people are paying our local, our parking stations downtown after 6 p.m. A lot of people don't know this, but parking's free downtown on nights and weekends. And people don't know that. I see people paying all the time. If outside the Dinosaur on the Court Street Bridge at 8 o'clock, you'll see tickets in every car window because people don't know they don't have to pay. Turns out a lot of people, so the city's not collecting a huge sum of money because, you know, you're talking about very small amounts. But, you know, something like 2,000 people a year are paying after hours to park downtown when they don't have to. The city doesn't have very good signage about that. So, you know, are those the biggest, most earth-shattering stories ever? No. But they did tell us something about our lives
sure.
here in Rochester.
And there have been some earth-shattering stories where you've used Freedom of Information.
I would say that FOIL has been the most useful to me over the last 10 years for the city school district and the superintendent employee group. I covered a lot of stuff and, you know, exposed side deals, lucrative contracts that the public never would have known about.
Rachel Barnhart, a reporter and anchor with WROC-TV. You can see her every afternoon at 4 on the Rochesterian blog, the most active Twitter user on Twitter, perhaps out of anybody. And Rachel, it's always nice to talk to you. Thanks for sharing your expertise on FOIL.
Thank you for having me.
David Riley from the Democrat and Chronicle. Always nice to talk to you, David.
Same here, Evan.
David, are you and Justin in the same baritone choir? Justin Murphy.
We should be. I love
the best radio voices happen to be in newspaper reporters, seething with jealousy. Great stuff, and I hope you enjoyed hearing how freedom of information law works and sometimes doesn't in this state and this country. Great afternoon. I will talk to you on a Tuesday on member-supported public radio.